The signs are posted all over town. Have you seen Honey? We've all seen the posters, but nobody has seen Honey the cat. Nobody. Until last Thursday morning, when Miss Colette Pacine swerved her car to miss Honey the cat as she drove across a bridge. Well, this bridge, now slightly damaged, is a bit of a local treasure and even has its own fancy name.
We sound a little bit better, and we're definitely very excited because now the Faculty of Horror has a brand new home in the Rue Morgue Vault.
That's right. We are recording from the same room that the Rue Morgue podcast recorded out of. The hallowed halls of the Rue Morgue podcast are now the horrid halls of academia, and we are recording the Faculty of Horror out of here forevermore. We've got a huge upgrade on equipment. We're not totally sure how to use all this stuff yet, but hopefully there's a noticeable difference in our quality, and we're so excited to be bringing you that upgrade.
And just to set the scene a little bit, so the Rue Morgue offices are in a, you know, nice kind of standard office-y space, and then in the middle of it is a vault, a literal vault. We are locked away in the middle of this office recording, so it makes absolute sense that our first episode here is about Bruce McDonald's 2008 film, Pontypool.
They're pulling two people out of a van. Oh my God, they're fighting.
What you are hearing is an actual radio broadcast. It is the only recording of the event.
Roadblocks preventing people from leaving and entering the area.
Everybody is under quarantine.
Clad!
We still do not have an official version of these events, and it's very difficult at this moment to get a fix on what has happened.
Oh, God! These people are trying to eat their way inside.
They cut into our signal.
Ken?
And their eyes. He's looking at me.
For your safety, please avoid contact with family members and restrain from the following. All terms of endearment. For greater safety, do not translate this message. Not translate. Just listen to me.
It couldn't be a more perfect time to record this podcast because I don't know where you're listening from, but in Toronto, it is about minus 40. It's been the case for the past couple of days. It's been so bitter cold. It's the kind of cold that it actually hurts. It just hurts your face, and it hurts your fingers, and you can't believe you're walking because you can't feel your legs. And I don't know if a lot of our listeners have this experience of this cold, but we're going to talk about Pontypool, and I think one of the reasons that I really love Pontypool is it's such a quintessential Canadian film that speaks to a lot of the Canadian lived experience, which we are going to discuss more fully in this episode.
Definitely one of the things I love about this movie, what really struck me the first time I saw it, I mean, from the title alone, Pontypool is a real town in Ontario. And so many of the other great Canadian horror films that have come from this industry, so like Black Christmas, My Bloody Valentine, Cronenberg's films, a lot of them are kind of set in this anonymous blank town or city. There's not a lot of Canadianness attributed to it, but Pontypool is fully Canadian. And as two Canadians, it is so exciting to see yourselves on screen to a certain extent.
That's right. And I'd also like to add that a lot of Canadian films intentionally obscure the Canadianness in order to appeal to American audiences. And this was the case most notably in David Cronenberg's The Fly, which is such an incredible movie. It was all shot in Canada, but they deliberately used American skylines and American money to obscure that fact. And it's an interesting factoid that Pontypool stands in stark contrast to. Also, the director, Bruce MacDonald, and the writer, Anthony Burgess, are Torontonians, and they are very present and visible figures in Toronto cinema. It's really not uncommon to see one of them hanging out at a Rue Morgue event or at the Festival of Fear. You see them around. Bruce MacDonald is quite a character. He's always got his trademark straw cowboy hat, and you'll see him out chilling and drinking on patios. Anthony Burgess at the moment kind of resembles Colonel Sanders, and he's really affable and friendly and happy to hear from you if you're a fan. I got the chance to interview him on a panel at the Festival of Fear last year. I did a panel on Canadian indie filmmaking, and it had Wolf Cop, it had the guys who were behind Septic Man and Ejecta and stuff like that. So I got to meet him and hang out with him, and I actually have a copy of Pontypool Changes Everything, which is the book by Tony Burgess that the movie is based upon. And I went to a screening and he was in attendance and I got it signed and stuff.
Oh my God, that's so rad.
It is pretty rad. I remember I presented it to him and I said, I'm working on a paper on the film and I'm really excited to meet you. And he was like, that's cool. And he signed his name and he drew a giant heart. I was actually pretty pissed off.
So I actually recently read the book. I picked it up. I always wanted to read it. And sometimes you need the kick in the ass that having your own podcast will give you when you want to talk about a topic like this. So I got it. I got an anthology of Tony Burgess's work. So I'm very excited to go through the rest of his stuff. And the book is so different from the movie, but he wrote both the book and the screenplay, so the same themes, the same tone, the same kind of bleak humor is really in there, and it's really present, and it was a lot of fun to read and then go back to the film and compare the two.
It's true. I think Pontypool is perhaps one of my favorite book-to-film adaptations, because what it does is it takes this very fragmented narrative of this very strange and interesting disease, and it chooses one little scenario that might have happened within this universe. And there's almost a found footage element to the books, which I'm sure you picked up on, but it's told from different accounts and different points of view, and the film translates that beautifully because the characters are cooped up in a radio station of all places, and they find out about this epidemic through accounts of people calling in. So there's kind of background for the development, which is so brilliant for an indie film, a low-budget film such as this, to convey so much panic and violence without actually having to show it, and it's so incredibly effective. I think I picked up on that found footage in that epistolary kind of format where you're drawing different things from different sources. And one of the things I feel like is so present, especially in the first half of the film, is for any of you that know Orson Welles' radio broadcast of War of the Worlds, which happened in the 30s, and it was the Mercury players doing their radio play, but it was done in such a way that it felt like a real news story. So people were actually freaking out, thinking that the East Coast and, you know, thereby the entire United States was being invaded by aliens. And it's still used as an emblem of the way we put so much trust into media, and how we don't question as much as maybe we should.
Oh, Pontypool, the book, is a very fractured sort of document. It's got pieces and slivers and fragments, and it has got sort of multiple perspectives and multiple beginnings and multiple sort of frames of reference. So it's not a very stable book, which was part of the challenge of turning it into a film. We had these discussions where the people were saying, well, this has nothing to do with the book. Well, the book has nothing to do with the book in some ways. The book is kind of randomly related to itself. And so the film I always thought of as being a chapter that the book imagined or forgot or could fit in.
So for the first time last episode, we mentioned that we were going to be talking about Pontypool. It's something new we decided to do to give you, the listener, a chance to watch the film and kind of bone up and prepare for our talk. armed with that knowledge. So to get right into it, Pontypool is a film that centers around a radio DJ called Grant Mazzi, and it opens up and he's driving into work. It is early in the morning, so it's just pitch black. He's driving through a blizzard. It's miserable. He's so tired. Driving into work, and he's working for the Pontypool local radio station, which isn't even really in a radio station. It's in the basement of a church, so it's kind of a makeshift DIY setting environment, which is, again, also very, very Canadian somehow. And you definitely get the sense that Grant Mazzi is probably from Toronto, or from some big city at least. He's got a big Toronto personality when he's on the air. He's got this persona of taking no prisoners, which puts him at odds with the show's producer, Sydney, who insists that he just report on the weather and school closures and the local news. And there's this struggle between them throughout of him wanting to do a big-time radio broadcast, and she kind of insists on reining him in, which is just slowly killing his spirit. Now, what happens in the film is it's early in the morning, they're talking the news, and they start getting some strange accounts of random violence happening. They're hearing that there is a mob scene outside of Dr. Mendez's office where people are literally swarming the building like insects, like climbing all over each other, crushing each other, trying to get in somehow, and babbling some strange random words. The reports come in, they're increasingly unclear and cryptic, but increasingly terrifying, as Grant and his station assistant, Laurel Ann, and Sydney are trying to find out. And eventually, Pontypool actually instates a state of quarantine where they cannot leave the building even if they wanted to. But they've got this radio station, so insofar as they're trying to figure out what's happening, they're also trying to communicate that news to the rest of the city. Eventually, they actually come in direct contact with Dr. Mendez, and they learn that what is happening in Pontypool is there is a disease that is being transmitted through language, through the English language in particular, and especially certain terms of endearment, which is interesting because the film is taking place around Valentine's Day.
On Valentine's Day.
And Valentine's Day was just last weekend, so it's increasingly relevant for us. But they learn that certain words are infected, and the infection is transmitted through comprehension. So it's up to this group who are isolated in this radio station to figure out what's happening and save the world from this zombie-esque language epidemic.
Now, one of the things I thought about a lot, and I've thought about this movie over the years in different ways and in different times, and obviously having a very good friend in Andrea, who is not only wonderful, but also happens to be a big zombie expert, one of the things I came at her with a little while ago was, is Pontypool a zombie movie? And I'm not sure. I would tend to put it in that category, but I'm just wondering, Andrea, what you think on the record.
Yeah, I would absolutely put it in that category, and I'm actually very glad to put it in that category, because if you're a zombie fan like me, you've seen it done so well, and you've seen it just done to shit more recently. You've seen it's a low-budget, easy thing to do with a lot of people and minimal special effects, and it's easy to pull off, and Pontypool was an example of a really, really novel twist, a uniquely Canadian twist, a linguistic twist. I'm going to count it as a zombie film based on what I believe to be the fundamental tenets of a zombie epidemic, which is that it's an epidemic that renders people unintelligible, homicidal, maniacs, and their condition is spread, and there's also an element of consumption involved. And I realize that's a very broad definition, but it still suits Pontypool to a T.
When Bruce and I first started cooking up this film, there was very little zombie on the scene. And then, you know, stomp, 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 zombie comes back, and then zombie, more zombie, zombie, zombie. Everybody talks about Night of the Living Dead or Dawn of the Dead or Day of the Dead or 28 Days Later, whatever. They talk about it in terms of it being this, it's a really a metaphor for, you know, clearly blah, 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 A is B, you know, of whatever communism or red menace or global warming, whatever it is that does that, right? To me, it's always been, here's the setup, here's the metaphor, here's the thing coming at you, la, la, la. But it's really a metaphor for metaphors that keep hunting you long after they've been meaningful. They keep coming at you.
One of the things I think is really special about the film Pontypool is it goes against the biggest tenet of storytelling or film, and it pulls it off, which is incredible. And that tenet is show, don't tell. But this film can only tell. They don't have a lot of visuals. We don't see a lot of zombies. It gets hinted at towards the end. We see bits and pieces. But ultimately, we are in the heads of these characters. They're just trying to disseminate insane information that is just constantly being thrown at them, and they don't know if it's a hoax, they don't know what it is, they don't know if it's real, and then when it is real, they figure that they actually have to stop broadcasting for a while to stop or at least impede the spread of the infection.
That's right. It's also a very smart movie. There's a lot of literary references. There's references to Norman Mailer. There's reference to Roland Barthes, who is a really interesting linguist and semiotician. And it's one of the smarter horror movies out there.
And it comes up very naturally throughout the film. And I think that's just a quality of a great screenplay. And, you know, even though I love Scream, they tend to hit you over the head with breaking down the formula of the film. And someone has to have a monologue, and they have to explain it. But ultimately, you have a character like Grant Massey who is trying to imbue this radio show with more and, you know, get more out of it. So he's bringing all this stuff to the table and it's going out there. And it gets really thrown out in the beginning. And then if you think about it, the more times you watch this film, the more you become aware of it and the themes that emerge from it. And it's so smart and it's so funny and it just works on so many levels. And that's why it's such a special movie.
So among those themes that we're going to talk about is small-town Canadian life. I encourage you to fire up Google Maps and look up Pontypool, and this is, honestly, I think it's like a block or two. This place is tiny, and I'm not sure how or when or where I was going, but I've definitely driven through Pontypool and seen the signs, and right away, the name of the place is Pontypool. What a preposterous place.
Which Grant even hints at the very opening of the film when he breaks down and Honey the Missing Cat with the actual name of the town.
That's right. There's really interesting wordplay in the introduction where he talks about, you know, the name Pontypool and the flat and Mrs. French's cat and Mrs. French. And there's a lot of French-English linguistic wordplay going on here, which I just dug so much. I don't know if I've mentioned on the podcast that I grew up in Ottawa. I live in Toronto now, which is very, very English. But in high school, I was fluently bilingual. I was in French immersion, and my French was really good until I moved here and I got out of practice. But I thought it was really refreshing to see in the film that these people have that really vague knowledge of French, that really basic knowledge that only Canadians really have.
And I don't think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but when I was a kid, I actually spent part of my childhood growing up in Montreal. And then I actually went back to Montreal to do my undergrad degree and actually stay on for another year and work and live and did all that kind of fun stuff. And Montreal is a party town, but it's also a town that is heavily divided by language and class, and it's a very interesting town to not only go visit, but to live there and really experience the discrimination that can happen based on language. So as the language comes up, and it becomes a really important factor, especially in the second half of the movie when Grant and Sidney, the producer, decide to talk to each other in French, and as Andrew was mentioning, they don't have the firmest grasp of the language, and French is one of our official languages in Canada. And then again, as the climax of the film approaches, you have the Quebecois riot police insurging on Pontypool, and their messages are in French, so, you know, we are being forced to listen and try to understand as we go forward with this language that we should know. We should know it, but frankly, a lot of us don't.
Je ne kill pas les enfants.
Oui.
Non.
Oui. Oui.
Non, tu vas kill enfants. Pas moi.
And that's, again, a very interesting contradistinction with Canadian culture versus American culture. Racial segregation is kind of a big deal in American culture. I remember my my Black Museum partner, Paul Korab, was talking about how he recently took a trip to the States and, well, I have to get from point A to point B and I'll just walk through this neighborhood. And his American friend was like, you cannot walk through that neighborhood. That is a black neighborhood and just don't do it. And he's like, what are you talking about? And he walked through, and while he never felt threatened or anything like that, it was definitely an eye-opener at how people looked at him. People literally coming out of their houses and being like, holy shit, there's a white guy walking through here. We don't have that so much in Canada, but we do have the divide between French and English, which isn't a visual divide, it's a cultural and linguistic divide.
So we touched on earlier some of the theories that get mentioned throughout the film, and I want to touch on what Grant Massey talks about with Roland Barthes, because I think it's so emblematic of the whole film. And I spent a lot of time, especially my master's, thinking and writing about Roland Barthes. So Grant mentions that Roland Barthes says something, that trauma is a photo without a caption.
You know, the French philosopher Roland Barthes once described trauma as a news photo without a caption. And that, folks, is what I think we have here now.
Stop understanding Stop understanding what you are saying. Stop understanding and listen to me. Sample. Sample is a color. Sample is a color.
Okay, no, Grant, no, Grant, you're making sense. Okay, if you say don't understand, it defeats the purpose.
Kill his kiss. Is that it? Hey, kill his kiss.
And then in Grant's final statement, which I get chills just thinking about, and it makes me want to like stand up and applaud as a proud Canadian, where he talks about that the apocalypse is just another day.
And today when Armageddon leached out into your good mornings, you know what? It's just another day. Another day in Pontypool. The sun came up, you did what you did yesterday, and it's exactly what you'll do tomorrow. Today's news, folks. Today's late-breaking, developing, just across my desk news story is this. It's not the end of the world, folks. It's just the end of the day.
I mean, not really a pedophile. We just never let our kids go anywhere near him.
And we see this wealth of knowledge and understanding that she suppresses for reasons that she thinks are important. Maybe they are important. And I love, again, in the final moments of the film, when they've been locked in that back room, where they're just trying to survive and these zombies infiltrate, and she's just writing things on the wall, and, you know, she writes something like, I'm Sidney Dyer, and today I killed a little girl. Right, it's like a confessional. You know, she's finally let out all of her true understanding and that she's been suppressing throughout the rest of the film. It's also really interesting that it's a makeshift radio station in Pontypool. It's in the basement of a church. Ken Loney isn't in a sunshine chopper. He's in a car on the top of a hill. And Grant Mazzie is, frankly, he feels like it's a bit beneath him doing this stupid local weather when he really wants to deliver the punches and deliver the news. But when shit hits the fan, that Pontypool radio station becomes so pivotal. It becomes really important for disseminating knowledge of what's happening, but also when Grant figures it out, insofar as he's able to before he's shut down, it just kind of goes to show you that radio is a very, very important form of media. And it also becomes a source of knowledge because, as we see very early on, is that the BBC actually calls in to get more information, and they kind of try to interview each other about it, but Grant doesn't have any more information than really the BBC guys who maybe have footage or something outside of what they know within that station. So there's this really interesting juxtaposition between the two truths that are necessary. You know, Grant Mazzie kind of wants to poke fun at the alcoholic OPP, but Sydney is like, no, you can't do that because these people have to live their lives. So she represents an element of censorship, but when push comes to shove, the truth needs to come out, and that's when the radio show really shines. She also represents a huge part of the humanity of this town, because we can talk, like, Andrew and I are both from very large cities within Canada, and I say we're both kind of city girls, and we're like, small town Ontario, they're so small there. But there is real humanity, and there's a lot of problems within those small towns, and I'm sure small towns all over the world, they feel like a trap, and you don't know if you can ever get out of them, and they feel so small. Now, I think I mentioned before that I had written a paper on Pontypool. This was maybe 2 or 3 years ago. My God, I can't believe it's been that long ago. I was approached by an old professor of mine back in Ottawa. When I wrote my thesis, he was the horror film guru of Carleton University. He's seen Zombieland and a couple of documentaries about
Pedro Loisel sent us all some emails that he was putting together a book, and it was going to be called Terror of the Soul, Canadian Essays on Horror Cinema. And so I became involved. I pitched a paper on Pontypool. Paul Korup became involved. He pitched a paper as well. James Burrell from Rue Morgue magazine. There was a bunch of people involved, and it had a pretty tight deadline, and we all met it, and we got it off, and we're like, ooh, sweet, another publication under our belt. That book has been in publishing limbo for the past several years. Maybe once every 6 months, I get an email from Andre saying, here's where we're at. It's coming. It's happening, guys. I swear to God. I think it's because he's trying to go through University of Toronto Press, and they just have a really rigorous review process, and I've had to make edits that I didn't want to make. And I have since published papers in other books, but none as arduous as this one. But anyway, my paper was called Viral Culture, Canadian Cultural Protectionism in Pontypool. And basically, I wanted to talk about what was so Canadian about Pontypool. It has a very certain Canadian-ness to it that I really wanted to explore. Now, for those of you in Canada, and even those of you outside of Canada, you probably know that Canada tends to define itself in contradistinction to the U.S. I'd say for myself, I had the opportunity to read Andrea's paper, so I really hope this book gets published, because it is fantastic, and I think you guys would all get a really big kick out of it. But I want to mention that I'm actually a first-generation Canadian, because my mother's American and my father's British. So you want to talk about two world powers, and, you know, a daughter trying to find her way in Canada and the Canadian identity, and always defending it, but feeling, you know, I'm also really British in some ways, and I also have my mom's American optimism. And there is something very intangible about Canadian-ness. We are always in opposition to other things. I don't hear a lot of Canadians say, well, we are Canadian, and we are X, Y, and Z. I hear, well, Americans are X, Y, and Z, so we are A, B, and C.
So what do you think separates Canada from the rest of the Western world? I mean, besides geography, what makes Canadians unique or different than, say, you know, the U.S. or the U.K.?
I think that the country was founded on the idea of there's enough for everybody, and that there was never any conquests when the frontier, so to speak, were being opened up. And there was always the invitation and inclusion of people, of cultures, to come and try, right? Give us your best, or bring your ideas. And there's enough room, there's enough resources, and there's enough space, right, for all things. But you just be committed to it, and we'll see if it works here.
That's right. And some of that has to do with history. You know, the U.S. broke from the British Empire and the American Revolution, while Canada, you know, stuck with the crown, which kind of painted the U.S. as this wild child and Canada as these goody-goodies. And even if you look at the national symbols, the U.S. has their eagle, and it's all about liberty and free will and stuff. And Canada kind of goes with order. There's the Mountie and also nature. The Maple Leaf. Biggest fear is extinction. There has been writing on this, mostly as regards literature. Northrop Frye wrote that Canadian literature was preoccupied with our harsher environment, and he coined the term the garrison mentality, which is a fear of being overpowered by outside forces, which is something he found very pervasive in Canadian literature, that Canadian characters tend to be very outside-looking, and they're preoccupied with building walls to both shelter and segregate. Now, Margaret Atwood, a very prominent Canadian literary figure, kind of picked up where Frye left off, and she identified survival as a central theme to Canadian literature and culture. It's basically, by the time the U.S. had set its feet in and was starting to make movies for entertainment, Canada was still kind of just trying to survive the harsher elements. And indeed, some of the first Canadian films were about the wilderness and about how it was to survive. So while Canada doesn't really need to worry about surviving winter anymore, we've got our infrastructure up and whatnot, we still struggle to survive culturally. And that's, like I mentioned before, keeping relations good with Quebec, who are always threatening to separate, to have their own autonomy, and keeping distinct from the U.S.
And I will say, one of the things that I found very interesting, especially being an entertainment writer and a genre critic, is we have a couple institutions in Canada that are really paramount to the success of Canadian film. And when I say success, I mean they just keep making them, and hopefully an audience will eventually find them. So those are things like the National Film Board of Canada, the NFB, or the CFC, which is the Canadian Film Centre. As Andrea mentioned, local tax shelter films and government credits. And my father, who is British, was actually brought over from London to Canada because of the NFB. They needed more skilled directors to come in and like work on things and develop ideas and get stuff out there. So they were bringing in people from other countries who had established film industries, who had the skills and the knowledge to start building from within Canada. So there was already a sense that it was being kind of decentralized from our own Canadianness. It was other people coming in and teaching us how to do it, which in a lot of senses it does have to happen like that, but it still feels very unpatriotic to think of it like that. It almost seems inauthentic. And the government intervening on Canadian culture and Canadian cinematic output is a really interesting thing because on one hand, it kind of really validates cinema as a very important art form. Like if Canada wants to exist culturally in this era of globalization, we need to have a stronger cinematic force. So they had the tax shelter, which gave rise to tremendous creativity, like David Cronenberg. I don't think we're going to get away from talking about Cronenberg when we're talking about Canadian horror film. He benefited greatly from Canadian funding from the government, but at the same time, he was lynched because people who didn't like horror could say that my tax went to this trash. And there was a very famous controversy where a writer by the name of Robert Fulford wrote this really iconic headline about Cronenberg's Shivers, and he wrote, "You should know how bad this film is. After all, you paid for it." And it sparked such a controversy about what it is Canadian government should be funding, what it is our Canadian output should be that reflects best upon our country. And it was actually a really shitty time, I would argue, for Canadian cinema because it largely censored it. And when you try too hard to pick your culture and exploit that, it's insincere, it's inauthentic. I think that's why the character of Grant Massey resonates so much with us, because he is screaming against the wind and, you know, Sydney, who's just trying to keep the status quo and, like, what the locals want to hear and what we all think they should hear. And he wants to, like, blow the doors off and just scream and yell and make people upset and really engage them as listeners. And he has a whole speech about how, you know, an upset listener is a listener that is engaged.
I am trying to piss a few people off because that's how it's done. Simple as that. You see, a pissed off listener
is a wide awake listener, and he ain't gonna change the station.
In fact, he may just call his pissed off brother and get him to listen too.
And then his pissed off brother, he might call his
pissed off, I don't know, preacher. And that, Lady
Briar, is how you build a loyal
listening audience.
Canadian film scene, and I think Pontypool is just another incredible
greater safety, please avoid the English language. Please do not translate this message.
When she starts to break down. It felt to me, especially I've watched it a few times over the last month, to really get a handle on it, to talk about this film, and it really feels almost like a thematic metaphor for post-traumatic stress syndrome, and these people who just kind of fall apart inexplicably, and it's so traumatizing to watch them because they were the strong people who defended us and defended our ideals, and they're the first to crack when they come home.
That's right, and I feel like that scene actually really speaks to that whole picture without a caption thing, because she says something to the effect of, yeah, I saw a lot of fucked up shit, but where I am right now, I'm not seeing anything. I'm only hearing it, and it's that much more terrifying, because I have no idea what's going on. It's really chilling in a different way, and I feel like that scene really spoke to that. Now, as regards the military, I think it's really shocking when the BBC comes in, and they're the first to suggest or even imply that perhaps French separatist groups are kind of coming at arms, and you just see Grant's face, and he's like, what? What the fuck? We are trying to survive here. And it's not organized. That's the thing he keeps saying, is it's not organized. It's not insurgents. We don't know what it is, because this is happening randomly, seemingly. But nonetheless, when push comes to shove, and even though Grant appears to have found a cure, not just a prevention, not just a survival mechanism, but something that could actually cure the residents of Pontypool, and he takes to the airwaves, all of a sudden there's this countdown in French, and he and Sydney just instinctively know, they're like, this is it, and they embrace in the radio room as it counts down, and then it's just white, and I hope you found this film as effective as I did, especially in that moment. And then you think the film's over. You wonder if they lived or died, and that, for such a thought-provoking film to end on an ambiguous note like that is an extra great kick that I love in horror. I always love when that happens. But if you tuned in after the credits, there's a really interesting little epilogue. And I remember I enjoyed it when I saw it, and it wasn't until I was sitting down to write this paper that I was like, I'm going to have to try and make sense of that. I thought it was such a beautiful little scene that I almost didn't want to overanalyze it or make sense of it, because it's complex, and we've got to talk about it, though.
Oh, my gosh. Well, first, I just want to mention that over the credits, as the credits play, you hear different reports of how the Pontypool tragedy is being handled by outside media sources, and it goes on, and so we're kind of getting that there's a bit of a conspiracy, maybe a cover-up, and it's going on, and, like, it's so perfect for the film. And then in the last moments before this epilogue, there is actually a really eerie thing where the BBC reporter comes back, and he's talking about it, and then he just starts repeating and repeating and repeating a word. And I was like, oh, no, it's so scary.
That's right, and these accounts also seem to imply this posthumous heroification of Grant Mazzi. So you definitely get the sense that he and Sydney did not survive the onslaught. And yet this epilogue has them in a very stylized environment. It's black and white that is so stark it almost reminds you of Sin City. And, you know, he's got sunglasses on and he's playing around with a gun, and she is dressed in this kind of like a kimono style, and it definitely looks like a very foreign, possibly oriental environment, but you can see the snow falling in the background. And they have this really strange dialogue that, once again, is full of wordplay, just like the intro, so it kind of has that nice continuity that we went out on interesting wordplay and we went in on it as well.
So this is one of the interesting things, and I feel like watching the film as much as I have, especially recently, I should be able to come at you guys with, this is what the ending means to me. That's what I'm about, this is what I do. And I watched that ending scene again right before I came over here to record this, and the only thought I had was that in some way these two have been kind of martyred in this really heroic, iconic kind of way, and that's the way they went out on. And I don't know if that's right. I still don't have a grasp on that last scene, but I love it, and I love how abstract it is. Those are the moments of, like, a hero and a lady and how they go out. That's what I have on it.
I think that's, that pretty much corresponds to the sense that I get when they're talking, and then Sydney says baby, and Grant actually shushes her. It's the last split second of that epilogue, and to me, I found that to confirm that they were right, that they had, in fact, solved it. And even now, in this weird, I hate to say limbo again, they're in the same limbo that my paper is in, existing in limbo that's still snowy and hellish, but in the end, they were right. I do feel like that's a weak and specious analysis, but if you guys can do better, we would love to hear your theories on that epilogue. I really would.
Oh, my gosh. I definitely would as well, because when we go to talk about films and when we pick the films and we pick the themes, I will write down every idea and thought I have about it, how I want to talk about it, and theories I want to bring in. But I will also go and try to read a couple other papers after I've done that to see, like, okay, these are the things that are coming up, and this is a lot of thematic things, so I'm not excluding anything. And I feel like Andrea does the same thing. And so I did that with Pontypool, but I didn't see a lot of people talking about that ending. So I think it's still a problematic thing just in the fact that we don't get that clear handle on it. But as an audience member, especially I think because Andrea and I respond so emotionally to this film, that it still feels in keeping with those characters. And it's like, you know what? Fuck yeah, that's how I want to remember those characters. They're the characters who kiss is kill and kill is kiss, and they are off having amazing cocktails with a snowy background behind them. Mm-hmm. One of the things that really sticks out for me about Pontypool is how much this film plays in opposition. And it starts with something small, which actually just jumped out to me in the last viewing I had of it, which was this morning. So the opening dialogue, which we talked about a bit already, where Grant is talking about Pontypool and Punta Flat, and we have that, and it's kind of playing again as he walks into the station, and it comes in, salutes Laurel Ann, it's very sweet and very kind and funny, and she says to him, I loved your Isn't That Ironic this morning. And that all of a sudden bells went off in my head, because Isn't It Ironic is a very famous song by one of Alanis Morissette. And the whole point of that song, especially after it was released, was that she actually doesn't get a hold of the word ironic. Then there are also moments where Laurel Ann is coming to the disease, and she is throwing herself against the window of the sound booth, and Dr. Mendez and Simi and Grant are all in there trying to stay safe and quiet so that she can't track them. And Simi is having a conversation on her cell phone with her children, who are with their father, and she's singing them a Happy Valentine's Day song. And it's like closing up on her, and she's trying to be kind and talk to her children and get a point across to them. And you have a woman throwing herself, like bloody, to get at them, to like rip them apart. And then another really interesting moment for me in the film is when they try to go outside, and they come back in, and Cindy's freaking out, and all of a sudden Grant realizes that, okay, if Cindy's freaking out, I need to step up, and I'm going to take control, and I'm going to play this game. What's next? So then they decide to do obits. And they don't have anything pre-recorded, so they have to do live obits, which makes no sense how they would get them, but it is the obits of a zombie apocalypse. And they talk about how families are destroying each other and ripping each other apart. And you have all these, like, grainy static images of these families from these small towns. And the narration is telling you that they killed each other, and they ran each other over the car, and they killed each other. And we are constantly being put at odds with what we are seeing visually. And I think it's a real comment on how much we can trust or how much trust we do put into our senses. And when one element of them is taken away, how so much of our language and our understanding falls apart.
It's true. And another interesting contradiction within the film is that they keep mentioning that it's terms of endearment. Terms of endearment are the problem. But when you look at the group who get trapped within the radio station, none of them actually get stuck on terms of endearment. But for Dr. Mendez, it was brief. For Sydney, it was kill. For Laurel Ann, missing.
Missing. Missing. Missing. Missing. Missing. Missing. Missing. As in, miss. I mean, Mr. Mazzy.
Now, these are not terms of endearment, but it was Valentine's Day, so terms of endearment were probably floating around more than they should have been, and as such got attributed erroneously
So we are getting these snapshots of people's lives and, you know, what they missed or something that is triggering them in their own head. I also want to talk a little bit about the direction of the film. We've already mentioned Bruce McDonald, and I think as a film director, you have to be as ninja, shall we say. And a good director is almost an absent director. You don't feel them too much. You just know you're watching a really great film and that you're enjoying it. What I loved as I rewatched it all these times, and it kept me with it every single time, is that in that first half of the film, before Laurel Ann succumbs to the disease, that's how I mark it, is there's a lot of the trio sitting and working. And so you feel the camera pan around them, this camera that is always in motion and surrounding these characters as they are static, to get that sense of a disease kind of lingering around them or about to attack or something's about to happen. And then as this kind of climax of the film happens, the camera remains a lot more static, and I think you feel the emotion of the characters is just coming through so much more. And I think it was an absolutely brilliant decision on Bruce McDonald's part to allow those moments, those tension moments, to really breathe and fill the room and fill the screen, and then know that when the actors are in it and portraying these things as well as they are, to let them have those moments because they speak so much more loudly than, you know, a huge fucking pan or spin or whatever Michael Bay wants to do these days.
I create visual worlds that are so beyond everyone's normal life experiences. And Hollywood is a place that creates a viewer escape. And what I try to do is, as a director, I try to... the type is all off, sorry, but I'll just wing this.
And maybe you believe it, maybe you won't, and maybe you actually have to go look it up on Facebook. Who knows? But we have a medium in decay, and we have people fighting against that and trying to make sense of it. And the fact that they are kind of the real landline and they are the real honest take on whatever is going on because they are living it, I think is actually really powerful and really exciting to watch. And I also think that, especially for McDonald as a director, I mean, my father, who's himself a director, always says one of the hardest things to do is to direct one thing in one space. And the fact that Bruce McDonald makes it interesting and makes another medium that interesting is so exciting and so special.
It's true, the information age has really changed everything. From the emergence of the internet, the fact that we can get our news through these less reliable sources, I mean, look at Wikipedia.
up the BBC broadcast online.
Yeah.
So we kind of know that it is really happening and that it is really BBC. But that's about it. But really, I take Pontypool as a trio of people screaming to be heard and screaming to be understood and fighting against forces that are telling them that they're wrong or that they should stop. And it's a really humanistic horror film, and I love that. We mentioned this before in the podcast, but I love when humanity is screaming to be heard, because that's one of the few things we have left that technology hasn't taken away. I mean, unless Skynet gets to us before we do, but we still have our humanity. We still have our understanding and our compassion and our caring, and that's what Pontypool does so fucking well.
So that's our show on Pontypool. We were dying to do it because we love this movie. We love that it is a quintessentially Canadian horror film, and Canada's a good place to be for horror right now. There's a lot of great talent coming out between the Soska sisters. Astron 6 is really killing it. And Ashley Wessel, a good friend of ours, is working on putting out her first short film. You might have caught our little mini-episode where we interviewed her. I hope you heard that. And her campaign is still live, so we strongly encourage you to go give her a hand with her movie, Inc.
We donate our vision to Ashley Wessel.
For our next episode, we've picked another huge film that we've been dying to talk about. It's one that we have heard suggested from you guys, so we're happy to finally bring it around. And it's actually interesting timing, seeing as last March we looked at Evil Dead.
We will be going back with the film Cabin in the Woods.
Oui, le cabin in the woods.
The maple syrup, cabin nap.
So in case you're not Canadian, or even if you are Canadian and don't speak French, that's cool too, our next episode is going to be on Drew Goddard's Cabin in the Woods. But until then, office hours are closed.
Cigarette break. It's like 10,000 spoons.